I'm a little bit confused, or puzzled rather, how it happened that every time I come, I seem to be talking about the day of the Lord, preparing the way of the Lord, the difficult and dramatic times as the day of the Lord approaches, those kind of things. And the same will be true today. And honest, that's not my choice. Like you here, I tend to follow the discipline of the lectionary. So the readings from Scripture are the ones that the church worldwide in many places will be reading today and in the past. So I don't know. Maybe the good Lord has something in mind here in terms of what the message that I'm supposed to bring you. This is the third time probably. Well, maybe you need to hear it the three times. But here is the passage, and comes from Mark chapter 13, the first 8 verses. And this is what it says. As Jesus came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." Then Jesus asked him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" Then Jesus began to say to them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. When you hear wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs." This passage from the Gospel of Mark is the beginning of what sometimes is called Mark's little apocalypse, where Jesus speaks of catastrophic signs, and later on there's the chapter of persecutions, the abomination of desolation, and the Son of Man coming in the clouds. It's a rather peculiar chapter, chapter 13, and wedged right between the description of Jesus visiting the temple, teaching there, noticing that one widow who puts her last mite into the collection box. And then on the other side, chapter 14, the plot of the chief priests and the scribes to arrest Jesus, and then things start going on very quick, leading to the events of Jesus' arrest and crucifixion and death. And right in between these fast-paced stories, there is this chapter of Jesus talking about the Jerusalem temple being destroyed, talking about cataclysms, wars, and the coming of the Son of Man, the day of the Lord. Well, much of Jesus' language and imagery comes from the Old Testament, from the book of Daniel. And especially that part of Daniel that was written when a Greek king overthrew Jerusalem and desecrated the temple sometime before Jesus. And that's another example of this apocalyptic kind of writing. And then, of course, our Bible finishes with another apocalyptic writing, the book of Revelation, the last book in the Bible. I don't know how you feel about such writings. Whether you're fascinated by those strange words and pictures that it paints, or perhaps you feel quite uneasy, quite uncomfortable about them, especially if you've seen people using them to predict the end of the world in the near future, which usually doesn't end very well, does it? Or perhaps, like many, you're just confused a bit by words like these, and not quite sure what we're supposed to do with them. today when we hear them. What might help us this morning is to remember that apocalyptic writings we have in the Bible have emerged from times of distress and uncertainty and sometimes despair. And they're there to offer consolation that whatever the present chaos and the lawlessness of human society, God is still God, as we were singing and praying before. God is faithful and God will act. And the future does belong to God, no one else. The purpose of such writings is not to confuse us and get us into complicated calculations about what this and that means. It's to encourage the believers in the midst of affliction to take heart and to be ready. What might also be helpful to know is that in spite of what some movies and books might tell us, apocalypse doesn't mean the end of the world or the great cosmic battle between evil and good. It simply means revelation or unveiling. That's how we get the name for the book of Revelation. It's the unveiling, the apocalypse given to John. So although it may be tempting to think that the words of Jesus that we just heard, said to the public and then further to his disciples, it might be tempting to think that these words are specifically about the last days, they actually first and foremost are there to reveal that which has been previously unseen. A bit like a theater. There is a stage, and then there is this curtain which can be drawn back. And suddenly we see things that have been prepared for us, but we couldn't see them when the curtain was drawn. Now it is there in plain view. That's what apocalypse is. Imagine a cosmic curtain drawn back by the angel of the Lord. Suddenly, the words and the worlds revealed as God sees them. And suddenly, that curtain reveals the world as it will be in the future when God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. And those who heard Jesus' words, they would have understood the idea of such a curtain. First of all, there was a theater in Jerusalem. But even more importantly, there was a very important curtain right in the temple of the Lord. That curtain or veil separated the Holy of Holies from the rest of the temple. And from what we know, it must have been a magnificent piece of art made with embroidery of blue and fine linen, of scarlet also and purple, adorned with silver and gold representations of sun, moon, and the stars, separating the heavenly realm, invisible to the people, from the earthly world in which they lived. Well, now that we're at the temple, let's linger around it a bit more, because it is a sight to see. As you might know, the temple was the central feature of the Hebrew, of Jewish faith, of the Hebrew people. And the one that Jesus and his disciples were looking at was recently reconstructed by Herod the Great, the king of the Jews, who got to keep his power by collaborating with the Roman occupiers, with the Roman Empire. He rebuilt the temple because he was trying to appease the nation, who certainly weren't happy with him, and it was clear to them that he was a betrayer of the nation. But that was his way of kind of making peace with especially the priests and others, and he spared no money. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. It was huge. The whole project began about 20 years before Jesus was born and then continued into decades into the future. It was grand. If you've seen the pictures, say, of the Roman Forum, or perhaps had a chance to visit it in Rome, it was twice as big as that. And then there were these huge walls that supported the temple. They were composed of these great white stones as long as 40 feet, Some of them still stand there as part of the Western Wall. In other words, it was a statement. Build for the glory of God, seemingly, and in the future memory of Herod, as far as Herod was concerned. Or perhaps it was in the memory of God and to the glory of Herod. And then the front of the temple was itself a huge square decorated with great amounts of silver and gold. It could be seen from miles away by pilgrims who would be journeying to Jerusalem to worship there. And we are told that the gold on the temple reflected so fierce a blaze of fire that those who tried to look at it were forced to look away. It was blinding. It seemed, this is a quotation from the time, or close to the time, it seemed in the distance like a mountain covered in snow, for any part not covered in gold was dazzling white. What a place to come to worship. And so here we are in the Gospel of Mark during the week of Passover, when the city's population exploded as all these pilgrims arrived, and there was a whole jam of travelers, priests, and beasts, and lots of money being exchanged. And there many of them would have stood, gazing at this blinding wonder of the temple and thinking about how magnificent it was. And that's what the disciples say, don't they? Look at them stones. Look at them buildings. And then Jesus drops a bombshell. Not one of these stones will be left. All will be thrown down. As the disciples admire the magnitude of this structure, Jesus draws open this curtain to show them that despite their beauty, these buildings are not God's idea of what should endure. And that's a shocking message to swallow. The temple, the center of the faith life. In the midst of all the uncertainty under the occupation, when life is cheap, when many are fearing the calamities and wars that are set to be coming, there's this one constant, one stable, glorious thing, and also a memory of great things that God has done in the past for the people of God. It's a statement that God is still mighty, for mighty is his temple. I suspect that everyone who heard these words of Jesus was stunned. And that is certainly true about his inner circle of the disciples, the first four who he called, the first four who are listed among the 12 disciples, Peter, John, James, and Andrew. They can't wait to ask Jesus for an explanation. What did he mean by such an inciting statement? So when they climb the Mount of Olives, the temple still dominating the panorama of the city, they ask, tell us when. When will this be? And what will be the sign that this is about to happen? When? And what sign? Maybe we shouldn't be surprised, but Jesus doesn't answer their question. Instead, he starts with a warning. He says, see that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, I am he. But don't be alarmed. But wait a moment, what about the temple? Except Jesus doesn't seem to be bothered about the temple in the way that the disciples and everybody else does. He doesn't seem to be concerned about the blow to the reputation of God and God's people that the destruction of the temple would bring. He doesn't seem to think that the temple is the center of God's glory and the most important place where God would be worshipped. Rather, from what we see in the Gospels, he seems to be distressed that God's temple is no longer a house of prayer for the people, for all people. Instead, that it became a place where money and influence were the name of the game. Not a stone will be left upon stone, he says. And indeed, only a few decades later, the temple is destroyed. All was thrown down except for a few fragments that we now call the Wailing Wall. And that is not all. Jesus said there would be wars and rumors of wars. Nation would be raised against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There would be earthquakes and famines. And even this, said Jesus, was not the end. Only the beginning of the birth pangs. Birth pangs of what? Living with uncertainty was hard for the first century, first followers of Jesus. And it's just as hard for us, his 21st century disciples. I don't know about you, but today, in November 2018, I feel like we're living through some of that turmoil, the earthquakes and the cataclysms and wars that Jesus was talking about. There are natural disasters that are warning us that the times are out of joint. The massive migrations of people seeking a stable and peaceful life, fleeing violent, oppressive, and unstable regimes. Witness to the terrors that human beings are capable of inflicting upon other human beings. And then the extent of the catastrophe that is the global climate change seems to finally dawn upon us. And at the same time, it's dawning unto us that it might be too late to do much about it. Scary to read the predictions of the scientists. So scary that sometimes we just stop. What's the point? Some of us might be quietly making the calculation, how old would we be when the temperature is raised to this degree or to that degree? And others among us worry about what kind of life our children and grandchildren will be able to lead. And then add to that the political chaos, and I won't even start. It does feel like the end of the world, doesn't it? At least the end of the world as we know it. And at such time of uncertainty, we're especially prone to look for something that cannot be easily moved, something stable, something enduring. We're looking for big stones to rest our eyes and marvel at and take solace in. And I wonder what those stones might be for us. We might have a ready answer that Jesus is our stone and the only cornerstone. But just like with the temple, let's be careful that we do not confuse God with things that are related to God, things that perhaps represent God and have been part of the story of our journey with God, things dear to our hearts, but things that are not God. Let's watch for that tendency to erect such stones that may draw the attention and wonder of us all. In your case, it may not be literal stones, and I'm glad about that, but gathering in the school building has trained you well, I think, as a reminder of that. God's glory is never about the stone and mortar and brick. But our faith, our spiritual life, and our church, I think, are not free from the want for the desire of stability and power and prestige, for yearning for a majesty beyond comparison. So let's look at that. Let's see what we might be marveling at this morning. And then let's take that warning of Jesus. When such stones start to move about, when the last stable thing around us starts getting shaky, it can be really, really scary. And then, Jesus says, we really have to watch out, because in moments of upheaval, our desire is for someone to save us, and we then turn so easily toward false messiah strongmen who claim, I bring you security. I am he. Fake news will abound, says Jesus. Many will come in my name and say, I am he, and they will lead many astray. How easily would we be led astray? But you, says Jesus, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. That's not the end of the story. And they keep asking, but when will this be, teacher? We want to know when, so that we can be prepared, so that we can be ready. And yet, perhaps Jesus doesn't respond to that question precisely because we are invited to be ready all the time. We are to live as if in the last days. We're called to live always anticipating that activity of God at the edge of history. So I have a wee exercise for the end of times for you. What if we really knew, what if we were told that we had only 1 year left before the world comes to an end? What would you want to do personally? And what would you want to do for those 12 months as the church here? What would be the things you would focus on? What would be the things that you would drop? What would you count as the most important thing or most important things? And what would suddenly become much less important? Maybe that's a good exercise for the Advent time as it comes. To think seriously, just to imagine that. That's why God gave us the gift of imagination. What will we do with only 12 months? And then try to see what it would mean to translate it, even if we don't know. 12 months, 12 years, 120 years. I'd hope that in our last days, we would want to be better stewards of all the things that God has given us, better than we are now. And that in the intensity of the last days, we would live better, be better. That we would be focused like laser beams on things that last. And that's where that passage from the letter to the Hebrews offers us a reminder. At the end of that passage that Graham read for us, it says this: let us therefore hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who has promised is faithful. And let us consider how to provoke one another to love and good deeds, or to urge on each other in love and good deeds, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day of the Lord approaching. So that's what it is. Jesus calls us to live with the intensity of the last days whilst we live our regular lives. That's the task for each of one of us, and that's the task for us as the church. Because we cannot do it alone. Because we need each other to be able to see. See with God's eyes. Observe those signs and then take courage. And to encourage one another, to provoke each other for good works. Love that. That's a good kind of provocation. So yes, perhaps there will be famines and wars and terror and the destruction of things we consider to be most sacred and stable. They may take place before our eyes in our lifetime. But if that happens, or when that happens, do not be alarmed, our Lord says. It is but the beginning of the birth pangs. And that's the good news for us today. That's the source of hope. These are but the birth pangs for the world which is yet to come. The world filled with peace and justice and joy. Where death is no more, where every tear is wiped from our ears. Where God dwells with people. That's why whatever is happening around us, whatever great stones are moving around us, we can live with certainty, greater certainty, and with hope. Because we are invited to be part of God's inbreaking realm, which Jesus called the kingdom of God. And that will be true when days are good, and that will be true when it feels like there is darkness all around us, perhaps literally, and certainly metaphorically as a feeling. Which is why I wanted to invite you to finish with a song. It might be a new song, although I suspect the tune will be familiar to many. If not, just join when you feel ready. It can be sung in the evening because it talks about the shadows that are stretching and deepening. But I think it's also to be sung for times such as these. Being reminded of where our hope really lies in and what the task is before us. So that's my invitation, that we can sing together to each other and to ourselves.